Welcome back to the unique co-podcast with Altus State and Local Tax and Advisory and the law firm Arendt Fox. Today you'll hear part two of the three-part series with both Arendt Fox and Altus Group discussing hotel real property taxation in the District of Columbia. And once again, we're going to hand it over to our moderator, Ralph Taylor, who is a partner with Arendt Fox. And take it away, Ralph.
Welcome to part two of a three-part webinar on what you need to know about hotel real property taxation in the District of Columbia. My name is Ralph Taylor, and I am the moderator of all three sessions. In part one, David Linhoff provided an introduction to the tax assessment valuation of real property in general, followed by a more specific discussion of hotel valuations and why such valuations are different from the valuations of other properties. In this session, part two, our speakers will discuss more specifically how DC assesses the values of hotels and will identify issues that may unduly increase your assessment and the tax bill based on it. The final session, part three, will describe how you can appeal your hotel assessment if you think it is too high, and will discuss the costs and benefits of appealing. Our speakers today are David Linhoff and Jeremy Chetlik. David is a nationally recognized expert and author on hotel appraisals. He teaches courses on hotel appraisals for the Appraisal Institute, and he frequently provides expert testimony on hotel valuation cases in D.C. and around the country. Jeremy Chetlik is a tax consultant who helps clients minimize their real property taxes and mitigate the impact of real property assessments. Jeremy previously worked as the major property supervisor for the District of Columbia government, where he was in charge of commercial assessments of properties valued over $10 million. He also worked in the development of the income approach model that the district's Office of Tax and Revenue uses for commercial property valuations. More complete bios of David and Jeremy, along with the bios of all other participants in this series, are posted on the website. Jeremy, could you please start us off with a discussion of how OTR assesses the value of DC hotel properties for real property tax purposes?
Sure. Thanks, Ralph. I guess the best way to start this off is just kind of a recap of a podcast that we did late last year where we talked about the DC tax calendar, because we'll jump into in a few minutes how DC actually values the hotel, but without understanding the calendar, it's very difficult to understand why they do things the way they do. So let's start with today or this year. This year's assessment, they call it tax year 16. It's got a valuation date of January 1st, 2015, and then you get your values as of March 1st, 2015, and you have until April 1st, 2015 to appeal. That doesn't really change. It's been pretty set every year. Your income's not required to the district. Your 2014 income's not required to the district until April 15th of this year, as of 2015. So as you can tell, they don't have that 2014 income when they're setting your values.
By income, you mean the income and expense statement?
Correct. So they don't have any access to any income that your property generates when they're setting the value. The only income they'll have as of the first of the year of this year will be the 2013 income. And that's something kind of important to remember when you're thinking
about... That's calendar year 2013.
Calendar year 2013 income, right. So did your income go way up? Did it go down? Did it stay flat? What happened with your income between 2013 and 2014? Because if you're going to present an appeal to them, you need to know they're going to get your new updated income. And if your income went up, if it doubled, you might be best to kind of step back. But Matt Wright and I... Matt from Arendt Fox and I will jump into that kind of in part three of this podcast. But I just wanted you to kind of understand that calendar. Now, as you go through that, the valuation date is 1/1/15. You're paying those taxes in March of 2016 and September of 2016. So you have about a year to kind of get the value right before you're actually paying on that, which is something that DC does well and better than a lot of places. Most places say, here's the value, now pay us. And if you think we're wrong and we agree we're wrong, we'll give you a refund, which is kind of a headache. But if you'd like more information on the tax calendar, that podcast that we did last year, we'll repost that podcast and also the printout that was provided with that on the Altus blog. But so why we're here, the getting into the hotel valuation of D.C., it's changed over the past few years since I left. I left the D.C. government 4 years ago, almost exactly. But the one thing that has stayed consistent over the time is that they rely on the actual income figures from the year that they have. Unless your number is way off, like your food and beverage expense is 500% of revenue, they're going to use the actuals, and they've been pretty consistent with that. Some components are stabilized, and that's the management fee and the incentive management fee, which are stabilized at 3% and 1% respectively. They then take a franchise royalty fee of 4% of room revenue. And from the publications I've seen, that 4% is actually below market. We've kind of had this fight with them. The assessors are often not really willing to change anything that's kind of set in their model. So it's just something to consider. If your franchise fee is 6% or 7%, like most flags are, you're only going to get credit for 4%. The main problem with that, and I think David might jump into this a little bit later, the main problem with that is if you could get away with only paying a 4% franchise fee, you would do that. But if you're paying 7%, it's to generate the income that you're getting. So by using the income that you're getting and then saying, well, you're overpaying on your franchise fee, it's just not realistic. So then DC does a pretty good job of addressing the FF&E issues, the furniture and fixtures. The main thing that they do there is, I'm sorry, furniture, fixtures, and equipment is what the actual FF&E stands for. This year they take 2% of total revenue for a replacement reserve. Last year it was 5%, but then they give it right back by giving you 4%, which they call the return of FF&E. This is the first time they've actually had something called return of FF&E in the last 3 years. They had taken it away, giving you a higher reserve, and now they're just giving it back. So in addition, a return of FF&E, they remove the personal property taxes from the income stream. The final income and the capitalization, the final income is then capitalized at what they call a market cap rate. And this is where things get a little weird. DC produces what they call a hotel cap rate study in their pertinent data book. And this study shows national surveys of cap rates, which is the right way to do it. The assessor then adds they put this in this study, and I'll put it on here. I'll read it to you word for word. And this is quoting the pertinent data book. The 35 basis point difference between unadjusted and adjusted rate is the net result of adding the effective tax rate, which is 1.85%, and redacting the unadjusted rate to remove FF&E and BEV, unquote. BEV stands for business enterprise value. And then back to reading this. Of 150 basis points, thereby producing loaded cap rate for real estate only. And there's nothing that discusses where the 150 basis points come from and where that number comes from. What essentially they're saying they're doing is, as David said in part one, your lowest risk is the real estate. Your next highest risk is your FF&E, and the most risky part of this is the business enterprise value. They're saying, well, we've removed the FF&E because we've given you return on and return of, and we removed the business enterprise value because we took out the base management fee and the royalty fee. Also, as David testified, what they're doing in this situation, and I'll let him really jump into this, if you've got a $1,000 bond that you take out a three-year bond, you put $1,000 out, in the end of the day, you're going to get your $1,000 back plus a return. There's no reason for you to do a franchise agreement with somebody if you're only going to get the $1,000 back without any additional return. I'm going to hand it off to David to kind of jump into more details of this. But, David, hearing how DC does it and your experience at DC, do they get things right here, or is there an issue with the way they're doing things?
Thanks, Jeremy. There's an issue. It's a rather significant issue, and it's an issue that relates to our first podcast, which is by doing it the way they've done it, they end up with a value of, at best, the real property and the intangible assets, and at worst, a wrong answer for the value of the real property and the intangible assets. They are supposed to be taxing just the real property, so they're taxing too much. And I can say it's sort of interesting. I can see what they're trying to do here in terms of methodology, because just recently I gave a seminar at their request to the appeals board in D.C. at which the assessors attended. And what I told them there relates to, I'll give you a quote from textbook in the Appraisal Institute, Real Estate Valuation and Litigation, which was written by Jim Eaton, the chief appraiser at the Department of Justice, and he says the following. An appraiser must either extract the net income attributable to the business from the hotel total net income, so the residual net income attributable to the real estate can be capitalized into an indication of value, or develop a capitalization rate high enough to reflect the value of the real estate only when it is applied to the total stabilized net income from both the business and the real estate. So what the city is saying they're doing is they're starting with the income to the total assets, but they're deducting the business value and deducting the FF&E, so they end up with the income to just the real estate. And so if they take a cap rate from one of the surveys, which is where they cite their source for their cap rate, which is a cap rate for the total assets, the cap rate that they should be applying to just the real estate of the hotel would be lower. And that's correct. If they had removed the business value and the tangible property properly. But what they've done to remove, as they say, the business value is to deduct a management fee and a franchise fee. And this removes nothing from the nothing of the business from the real estate. These are simply the costs of those assets. And as I said in the first webinar, that would be like just giving the lender back the $100,000 loan and not paying him any interest. All you're doing there is identifying the return of the investment, and you're ignoring the return on it. And I'm going to quote another source, the California State Board of Equalization Assessor's Handbook, which says the following. The value of intangible assets and rights cannot be removed by merely deducting the related expenses from the income stream to be capitalized. Allowing a deduction for the associated expense does not allow for a return on the capital expenditure. So back to what DC does and what it does not do correctly. They don't deduct any intangible value. They simply deduct the cost of the franchise. And so the residual income that they are left with is income to the real estate and business. And that cannot be capitalized with a real estate cap rate, which is what they do. Now let's take a look at what they've done with the taking out the tangible personal property. They get close to doing this correctly. And as I described in the seminar that they attended and I gave for the Board of Appeals, the way that you do this is you get the value of the tangible personal property and you multiply it by a tangible personal property cap rate. And that rate would be higher typically than a real estate cap rate. But the problem with what they've done is that there is no support for the rate that they use to multiply times the value of the tangible personal property and thus get the income. And when you look at that rate closely, it is clearly not the appropriate rate to allow them to do that. So the bottom line is, Jeremy, what they do here is they start with the actual income, which may or may not be appropriate. I mean, if the hotel isn't operating at market, that income wouldn't necessarily be appropriate. They then don't deduct anything for the business because all they take is the franchise and management fees, and those are just expenses of operating the business. They aren't the return on the business. And then they incorrectly remove the tangible personal property, and so what you end up with is an assessment that's based on more than just the real property of the hotel.
Okay. Well, thank you, David. That's what I expected you to say. You and I met at a board hearing last year and presented this to the board and faced some challenges when the decision came, and it was kind of clear that they didn't quite understand it, and they didn't quite understand hotel valuations, which is really why it's so important to understand the appeal process. And unfortunately for some folks, the court process is quite confusing, but that's why folks like Ralph and Matt are available. And in part two and part three of this, I'm going to discuss more on part one and two of the appeal process, the first level and second level, and then Matt Wright from Aaron Fox will take over and really explain the very complex court process to go through in order to – that's going to end up getting a lot of these cases settled. So thanks again for listening, and hopefully we were able to help you along the way on this, and I look forward to speaking some more in part three. Thanks.